I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. On Monday morning, University of Pennsylvania student Olivia Kong was killed by a subway train, a suicide. She had been studying finance at the Wharton School. Penn President Amy Gutman said Kong was bright, well-liked, a successful member of the junior class in a message Gutman sent to the students. She encouraged the students to use the university's mental health services to help them deal with their grief. This is the 11th suicide at Penn in the last 3 years, making the university an outlier when it comes to students taking their lives. We asked a member of the administration to join us this morning on Radio Times, and they declined. We have two Penn students who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio, and let me introduce them to you. Lauren Feiner is the editor-in-chief of the Daily Pennsylvanian at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a junior at Penn, and Lauren, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us, Lowell Newman Nicky. He's a senior at the University of Pennsylvania, a sociology major, and Lowell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us from New York, from the NPR studios in New York, is Kelly Posner Gerstenhaber, the founder and principal investigator of Columbia Lighthouse Project. That's at Columbia University, a member of the board of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And Kelly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Grateful to be here.
Very, very good to have all three of you with us. And Lauren, let me begin with you. This was yesterday an apparent suicide. The medical examiner has declared this a suicide that happened on Monday. How are Penn students doing? I know there have been vigils and other get-togethers, if I can put it that way, of students coming together and talking. How were things on the campus?
Right. So on Monday night after we heard of Olivia's death, there was a vigil that was organized by a student that night in the center of campus. It was really moving. I think a lot of students are really upset and a little bit angry with the fact that this keeps happening. In the 3 years I've been at Penn, that's kind of the sentiment that's been building up. Like, why does this keep happening?
Anger at the school, just anger at sort of how can this be, broadly speaking?
I think both. I think the university has definitely taken steps towards improving mental health resources on campus, but I think it's still an ongoing issue, and students wonder what more should be happening.
I want to pick up on that, and let me get you in on the conversation, Lowell, and then I will turn to our third guest to get Kelly in on the conversation as well. And Lowell, one of the reasons that you're here is that you actually had two friends who were contemplating suicide, one coming rather close to actually committing suicide.
Yeah, about as close as it gets.
And you were there, or they turned to you for assistance. You obviously were able to talk them down, but nonetheless, what are you thinking these days?
I guess for me, the biggest question is to what degree should and maybe even can the school play a role in preventing these sorts of circumstances? I think it's a very personal issue for a lot of people. I think there are, just studying in school kind of obviously at the undergraduate level, but you kind of realize there are lots of different cultural reasons that people might take into consideration when making this decision, or maybe sometimes it's not even a decision that they are kind of conscientiously making. But I would, that's kind of the main takeaway that I have, even being, I've actually been at Penn for 5 or 6 years now, and I've kind of noticed, you know, as much as I'd like to turn around and say, why isn't the school doing more? What should the school be doing? When I ask myself that question, I'm not exactly sure what more they can do, because I would say they do a lot between CAPS, which is the psychological services, and student services, which have actually followed up pretty extensively with me about my experiences. They do a lot, but I always just kind of wonder, there are going to be those outliers who won't seek those services out because they're not comfortable, they're having mental health struggles. And I just, at a certain point, wonder what the school could do.
Well, let me just ask you one or two questions. You had two friends, and, you know, one literally was just about to jump off a building.
Yeah, that's correct.
And the other one, what, talking about suicide?
Yeah,
the
first friend, the one that did not actually get to the point where they were, basically about to jump, he was the kind of first-generation son of immigrants, and I think he expected things to just go a little bit smoother for him when he first came to Penn. And I think he had a really tough time reaching back to his very traditional parents and trying to explain to them what was happening in his life here.
Why he was struggling, perhaps?
Yeah, I believe he had sought a bid at an engineering or a business-type fraternity on campus, so less of a social one, more of a academic-focused. And he actually did not get a bid, and I think he just had a really, really hard time kind of coming to terms with that sort of, you can do all the right things, you can have all the right things on paper, but at the end of the day, if they might just not vibe well with you, and you might not get in. And I just think he would just have long, what's the point? Why am I still around? If I could put in all this effort, if I can try to be the right person, and I can still meet such what he saw as abject failure, is it worth continuing at this point? And, we would have long talks, and I could only say so much because I was going through my own, transitional phase as a freshman in college. But it was just long talks about, it'll probably get better, and even if it doesn't, I really don't think that's the appropriate course of action to take because there's always more things you can do. So that was the first friend. So that was more just kind of talking through as a friend. The second situation.
How's he doing?
He's doing much better. He has actually graduated on time within 4 years, so better than I could say for myself, believe it or not. He's doing very well. I believe he went on to graduate school. I think he's in New York right now, so he's doing well. We're in touch occasionally. It can be a little tricky to say, how's your mental health?
Yes,
so I just try to keep it almost a little superficial at this point. So he's doing it much, much better. My other friend, the story is more, he was going through essentially a disciplinary hearing with the school, and he was pretty convinced that he had not done anything inappropriate or incorrect, but the trial kind of took on this almost, I would say, Kafkaesque type nature where he felt that they were no longer interested in the truth or justice. They were interested in some level of vindictiveness, and that, I think, took a real toll on him psychologically, just his conception of what was fair and what the school was trying to do in this very specific set of circumstances. And, I would have conversations about them going through this whole process, and I could tell he was getting worse and worse. And one
more
night,
depressed,
exactly,
more desperate.
Yes. And one night I heard essentially a loud thump and a bang and a yell, and he had thrown the window open and was kind of leaning outside looking to take a head first dive, and I ran and grabbed him by the scruff of the shirt, pulled him back in. I didn't really know what to do at that point. I called psychological services. They said, "We'll call you back. We have somebody on call." It took a little bit. It was 30 minutes of me kind of sitting there just trying to say, "Stay calm, stay calm." And I ended up calling them back, and they said, "Oh, you're just going to have to take him to the emergency room because that's just the best option right now." And I did. I ended up taking him there. They did a fantastic job. It's really nice to go to a school where you have all these resources available right on campus. And he's doing much better now as well. He took a year off, came back, was able to get classes managed, and I believe he's going to be graduating this semester as well.
Let me get you, Kelly, in on the conversation, hearing from both of our students here in Philadelphia. There are several things. One is just the fact that within the last 3 years then at the University of Pennsylvania, we're talking about 11 suicides. And my understanding is sort of out of the sort of normal expectation of suicide on a college campus, if I can put it so crassly there. But you were listening to Lowell talking about two incidents where he had to intervene intervene with students that were contemplating suicide. How common is this? How common is this on a campus today?
It's incredibly common, not only on college campuses, but frankly in every community across the world. Suicide is actually the second leading cause of death in 10 to 24-year-olds. It's the number one cause of death among young girls 15 to 19 across the globe. So it's a problem everywhere we look, and clearly, particularly on college campuses, given that it's the second leading cause of death in that age group. And what's the biggest cause? The biggest cause is depression and other treatable medical illnesses. The problem is that people don't treat depression and other mental illness the way we treat other medical illnesses like cancer and allergies. We would never use the word choice when it came to cancer. Lola, you just used the word decision, and that's part of the job that we all need to do. We have tremendously effective treatments out there. When I say this is a treatable
medical illness. You know, since we have modern antidepressants like Prozac and Paxil, the suicide rate has dropped across the world, across ages, reversing a trend prior to their introduction. We have at least 9 existing psychosocial treatments for youth that work tremendously effectively to treat depression and suicidal issues in particular. We even have academics are having an increased clinical focus on the need and development of interventions and support groups for emerging adults. So, but when you read, even if you read the articles that happened, you know, that came out after this recent tragedy, you know, a lot of it is the same theme that I see throughout my work across the nation and the military. People don't, you know, you have a mental illness, what's wrong with you? You know, or in the military, it's man up. This is no different than, as I said, asthma, allergies, or cancer. And the and communities need to start to understand that that's what gets in the way of us getting people the treatment they need.
Well,
what
have we learned? Let me just jump in here because you said several things that I want to pick up on.
Yep.
One is the man up quality of this. And we're talking here on, especially University of Pennsylvania, these are Ivy League, or this is an Ivy League school where a lot of high achievers, a lot of probably people that were number one or number two in their high school class, and now they're on a university campus. Is there some kind of stigma associated with not saying I'm feeling bad, I'm not doing as well as I want to, I don't look as good as my fellow classmates here? About a minute before our first break.
Yes, there's absolutely that stigma, but it's not unique to an Ivy League campus. It's everywhere across the nation because, again, we have a lot of work to do to explain to people that this really is about a treatable conditions.
Treatable conditions in that we're talking depression, right, Kelly?
Yeah, depression is the biggest, most prevalent cause of suicide. You know, 90% of people who die by suicide have a treatable mental illness, most often of which is depression, but then anxiety and substance abuse and other things also are included in there. And so we know we need to screen. We need to screen for depression, and I'm aware of University of Pennsylvania doing that at every health service contact, for example. They're incredibly committed to finding the students that need help. So when somebody calls in, you know, to health services, they would get those questions. We know that 50% of people who die by suicide have seen their primary care doctor the month before they die.
Wow.
We should be asking these questions, direct questions, the way we monitor for blood pressure. One more statistic, you know, adolescent suicide attempters that show up to the emergency department are not there for psychiatric reasons. So we really need to be asking. And one of the things we've learned through working with colleges is that, and communities across the world, is that we also need to be asking, put these questions in the hands of lots of different people.
Well,
for people who are...
Sure. Hold on to that thought, only because we're up on our break here. We'll get back to our conversation. Examination of suicide, mental health on college campuses, including at Penn. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking about the fact that earlier this week, a junior, a finance major at the Wharton School, killed herself, killed by a subway train at 40th Street Station in West Philadelphia. Our guests are Lowell Newman Nicky. He's a senior at the University of Pennsylvania. Lauren Feiner, editor-in-chief of the Daily Pennsylvanian. She's a junior at Penn. And joining us from New York is Kelly Posner Gerstenhaber, founder and principal investigator of the Columbia Lighthouse Project at Columbia University. She's also a member of the board of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. One of the things, Lauren, that I read in preparation for today's show is something called the Penn Face. I was also reading at Stanford, they call it the duck syndrome. What is the Penn Face, and how does that factor into what we're talking about?
Right. So the Penn Face is essentially the idea that you know, no matter what is going on in your life, a lot of Penn students feel like they have to put on some sort of front, some sort of mask that says, I'm okay, everything's fine, I can handle this. Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult to deal with when, you know, people aren't okay and they don't really acknowledge that to each other.
Why do they put on the Penn face? I mean, what is it? What is, I guess, the pressure to look like you've got everything in control, under control?
Right. Well, I think a lot of people, when we talk about this, will often bring up the pre-professional nature of Penn. There's a lot of pressure to, you know, be involved in a lot of activities on campus, be career-oriented, be forward-thinking. And so I think that puts a lot of pressure on students to look and act a certain way and seem like they're able to keep up.
You want to add to that, Lowell?
I guess kind of my only thing with the Penn face that I've always thought about is that, well, what's the alternative? And is that a deer in the headlights look? Is that a constant state of panic? And obviously that's not a particularly employable useful state of being. So I do think that the Penn face and the duck syndrome can be important in that that's a big part of what, I mean, I'm sure we'll get a lot of older listeners that will say, well, these young millennials, that's just going to college, that's becoming an adult, that's learning how to put a strong face on and kind of grin and bear it. I think that is very important, but I think when it ties into mental health, I think it's a very important thing to look at and say, well, that may be a kind of reality that exists, but in what ways is it potentially affecting getting the treatment out to the people that need it?
But do you think,
and I just wanted
to
add,
ahead.
That's related to the stigma I'm talking about, right? It's okay not to be okay. Mm-hmm. And that's a reflection of, you know, where we need to go.
Well, and just picking up, Lowell, on what you were saying, which is that there are days when you have your Penn face on, and then there's the days when you feel like they're deer in the headlights. And, you know, that we all have multiple parts of ourselves. We have good days, we have bad days. But to think, and is there pressure then to always look like you've got it together?
I would think just giving the nature of elite academia, there is an added sense of pressure in that. You know what people around you are doing, big, incredible things. They're starting new apps. They're creating startups. They're doing research into curing cancer. They're doing amazing research in the fields of suicide, for example. Mm-hmm. And you kind of have this little bit of, well, man, I can't even get it together today and get out the door. What's wrong with me? And I do think that that's almost the nature of the beast in certain ways when you get into eliteness, quote unquote.
Yeah, and Kelly, I wonder whether this pressure or desire to somehow be perfect. I mean, does that factor into what we're talking about?
Not really. It might add to, you know, the intensity of some pressure. But what we're talking about here is not unique to Ivy Leagues or anything like that. You know, let me put some context here. 44% of college students report symptoms of depression. 49% of college students, any college student, say they've been so depressed at any one time they have trouble functioning. One in four have a fully diagnosable mental illness. So this is not unique to Penn or an Ivy League or a high-pressure situation. It is a time of transition. So it's a time where we have to carefully screen for these issues. You know, as I was saying, you know, depression is, did you know, the most debilitating disease in the world right now? Wow. In middle and high income countries? Wow. We estimate, soon to be everywhere, we estimate that at least 8% of adolescents have full blown major depression. So again, this, we just have to really focus on decreasing the stigma, having people treat it like any other treatable medical illness, and facilitate getting the people the help they need. And one of the things I was starting to talk about before is what we've learned. So we've learned that we need to screen, and that's just what Penn and other people, many, many other universities are doing across the nation. We've also learned that we need to be asking the questions and putting them in the hands of lots of other people in the community, because sometimes those are the people, like Lowell, you describing, you being there with with your friend or fellow student, right? Sometimes they're not going to go to the health center at those moments. So what are we doing in many places? As an example, at Princeton University, they're training the athletic coaches and the security personnel and the resident advisors on how to ask these questions.
Let me ask you just a quick follow-up to you, Kelly. As you said, pretty phenomenal statistics there. Is that are we better able to screen for depression, or are actually more young people depressed these days? Or do we know the truth in there?
I think it's a combination. You know, we see what we call cohort effects where, you know, there are increases right now in our nation. You know, suicide in middle-aged men has increased. But generally in this age group, it really has stayed the prevalent problem that I've been describing. And we have made a lot of progress in terms of, you know, identifying it and screening for it. And we continue to try to struggle with how we get treatment for people. Do you know that I was saying that the biggest cause is depression,
right?
But across the world, most people who need treatment don't get it. And it's because of this kind of barrier that I'm talking about, where people don't feel, because of stigma, that they can seek help.
Let me read something that Amy Gutman, the president of Penn, said in the fall at the convocation speech. I'm just going to quote a couple of things. She said, "Never hesitate to ask for help. That's what we're here for. Asking for help, far from signaling weakness or failure, is a most positive sign that you appreciate something very profound. No one, and that includes you and me, ever makes it through college, let alone life, on their own. The sooner we learn that lesson, the stronger and more successful we are likely to be." Those are positive and powerful words, Lauren. And both of you and Lowell seem to indicate that the university is trying to address this issue. Can you speak more to that, Lauren?
Right. So following several of these suicides, the university launched a mental health task force, and their recommendations later indicated a culture surrounding the stresses of Penn that contribute to mental health on campus.
Did they call it a culture of perfection?
I believe that was the term,
right.
Or something along those lines.
But
essentially, they have set up a lot more resources, helplines. They've increased counselors at Counseling and Psychological Services. But I think a lot of students still feel like there must be more to be done if this is still happening.
Like, I know there was some talk about a freshman if you're a freshman at Penn, having a counselor, access to a counselor assigned to you. I mean, things like that. Is that what?
Yeah, things of that nature. I mean, I think it's hard because no one quite knows what will help. And no one has the solution. But I think it's something that we need to keep working towards and need to keep trying alternate paths. And I think a lot of the frustration comes from the idea that these resources are set up and there's something that students still need to seek out. And if the problem is that there's a stigma surrounding the ability to seek out these resources, you know, there's still a problem there.
Well, Kelly, let me give you a chance to respond to that. We got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. As you said, depression is a treatable disease. Is it about changing a culture and environment on a college campus so that all students feel that they can access treatment, get the treatment they need, and not feel like they are somehow a failure?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's what I've been trying to explain, that it's so important in all of the people who really try to figure out across the world how we're going to help continue to address, to prevent this loss of life, this barrier of stigma and people feeling like there's something wrong with them if they seek help. That's what we have to continue to do. And I wanted to add to what we were just talking about, that if we don't screen, right, which is what Penn is doing in many ways by asking the questions at the health center, we will not find the people suffering in silence. And I think that's what we're all talking about. We have to keep learning, you know, what to do to find the people who need help while we're decreasing, you know, the stigma, the unnecessary stigma that is there. And the other thing I think that's important to note is we've learned a lot about what we can do and should do, and also a lot about what we shouldn't do. And that involves the media. You know, responsible journalism can actually be quite helpful as opposed to the opposite. More than 50 research studies worldwide have found that certain types of news coverage increase the likelihood of suicide in vulnerable individuals, and the magnitude is related to the amount, the duration. So as an example, we know that stories that describe the method, that glamorize the death, that give details of the scene, are not things that are helpful. They actually put people at risk. What we should be talking about is that this is these are treatable conditions, things that decrease the stigma as opposed to the opposite. And I think that was, you know, it's a very important thing for people to hear.
Absolutely. And that something can be done as opposed to something can't be done. Let me get Jim from Center City, Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a Penn grad. I graduated at a ripe young age of 51 last year and 52 now. I had a full career at the Philadelphia Stock Exchange. I was a partner in a trading firm. And now I work from home and I invest. My comments are, you guys keep addressing this from kind of like after the fact, top down. After the student has depression, we need to identify that. They need to reach out. My experience at Penn, this was just 2 years, one to 4 years ago, is maybe we should look at the stress that's involved with the student and the workload, which I'm sure your professional on the panel would tell you, stress just exacerbates everything. It causes depression. It makes it worse. And I think we have this default thinking with college education that we have to have this full five-course per semester course load. And all the students who were in the 18, 22-year-old with whom I had classes, their biggest gripe was, you know, the amount of work, the course load. Maybe we need to take a fresh look and make maybe 3 to 4 course semesters and everyone be mandatory to take a summer course, just to lighten the load up, de-stress, and then maybe we can just
I hear you, Jim. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. In fact, one of our reporters here at WHYY interviewed a friend of the woman who killed herself on Monday, and the friend said she told me it was mostly because of the stress at school. It was mostly school. Something happened. She fell behind on top of 6 classes. There were all these pressures. Lowell, you want to speak to that?
I guess because I've had a lot of friends that have taken 6, 7 classes. I'm currently in 5 right now. As much as we could, bring it down and kind of get everyone to, quote-unquote, chill out and only take 3 or 4 classes, you're going to have kids that then sign up for 5 because it's going to help them graduate sooner and get into a graduate school sooner and start making money sooner. And I kind of alluded before to the nature of the beast, quote-unquote, where it's just as much as we could try to mellow everything out. Like, it's Penn for a reason. It's the Ivy League for a reason. And I don't want to sound like an elitist, but I really do think that, you know, you're going to have people that are – no matter what, just because they're going to try to get ahead because that's the way.
Because they're ambitious.
Yes, that's the way it works. That's why they got into Penn in the first place.
You want to speak to that, Lauren?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Lowell, but also that said, I think that the structure of the academics at Penn is something that hasn't been fully looked at in this light. I mean, I know at MIT, after some suicides, they made classes for freshmen, I believe at least in their first semester, pass-fail. And, you know, nothing has really changed within the academics at Penn. And whether or not they should be is up for discussion, but I think it's a question that's worthwhile exploring.
Kelly, we have a caller I want to get on and give you a chance to respond to Tim from Allentown. Tim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty. This is somewhat cathartic, so I appreciate it.
Terrific.
I definitely want to echo everything that's been going on here, you know, in the conversation that, you know, this is something that we definitely need to take a look at and help people come and get help. I did so when I was a junior, and I didn't go to Penn, but I made the decision to get help, and things were, you know, I was seeing a counselor, and things were going in the right direction, I felt, until, you know, it was apparent that I had, you know, I had depression and maybe a little bit of suicidal ideation. And all of a sudden, like a ton of bricks, you know, things came down, and I felt that it was a big overreaction on the part of the counselor and the department there.
an overreaction
an overreaction to what I was thinking and what I was dealing with. And getting back to the stress issue, I mean, it was an inability to manage stress, which actually at this point in my life, I'm still dealing with. And that's because I was so turned off by my experience of what I felt was an overreaction that I just, you know, I didn't continue for years and years. I didn't go back and seek mental health help because of that, what I felt was an overreaction. So, you know, as we screen and as we do this, we just want to be careful that we don't do that.
Tim, that's such a good point. And Kelly, let me give you a chance to respond to that. It sounds like what he was saying is that he had these thoughts, this ideation, and the university responded, and he felt from his perspective it was an over-response. This is such a delicate issue.
Yes, and I think to be fair, universities and communities want to make sure with a life-threatening illness that people get the help that they need. And I wanted to just, again, give some perspective that pressure and course loads, those are important topics, but frankly, they're not the core issue here. Suicide is complex with many causes. It's not due to one stressor. As I said, the biggest cause is a heritable illness called depression, and depression actually impacts your ability to function. It not only makes you feel horrible, it impacts your ability to do your coursework. You don't want to get out of bed. As I said, many, many, many students, almost 50%, 49%, have felt so bad that they couldn't function. Mm. So we it's not particular to the kind of pressure that we're describing at an Ivy League school. I work with schools across the globe in South Africa. When you're dealing with a treatable medical illness, it cuts across all of these communities. So I think we need to continue to focus on what are the things that we need to really be trying to address. And as I keep saying, it's having people think differently about depression.
Well, we're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation with Kelly Posner, Gersten Haber, also Lowell Newman, Nikki and Lauren Feiner. We are talking about suicide, frankly, a suicide. Earlier this week in Philadelphia here, a student at the University of Pennsylvania. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about suicide, mental health at the University of Pennsylvania and at college campuses across the United States. A Penn student earlier this week killed herself here in Philadelphia, and we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Well, a little more than 2 years ago, University of Pennsylvania student-athlete Madison Holleran committed suicide by jumping off a parking garage in Center City, Philadelphia. She was 19 years old. Her family has founded a suicide prevention foundation in her name. Joining us is Madison's fifth-grade teacher, Ed Modica, who's been lobbying for two bills in New Jersey to help students who are contemplating suicide, the Madison Holleran Suicide Prevention Act and the Madison Holleran Proper Reporting Act. And Ed Modica, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's something that needs to be discussed.
Absolutely. What are in these bills? What do you want the legislature to do in New Jersey?
Well, in New Jersey, I had initially started a petition to have the legislation that I drafted be known as the Madison Holleran Law. It was wise of the Assembly of the 40th District, the legislators, to separate these into two acts, which they call the Madison Holleran Suicide Prevention Act and the Madison Holleran Suicide Reporting Act. The Prevention Act has already been okayed by the Senate by an unanimous vote of 40-0, and now we are just waiting for the Assembly to act upon it, and hopefully within the next 2 months it will be sent to the Governor Christie's desk for his signature.
And what will it do? And what will it do?
Well, we want naturally, the Prevention Act includes requirements for the colleges to have healthcare professionals, which are licensed in the area of healthcare, and they have to have training and experience in mental health issues, and they must focus on reducing suicide and attempted suicide, and they must be available either remotely or on campus 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we also want to require that these licensed healthcare professionals work with the faculty and staff ways to recognize the warning signs and risk factors associated with suicide.
Ed, we don't. Yeah, if you don't mind, only because we don't have the greatest phone line, and I'm sorry, we're missing some of what you're saying there. But that's okay. But let me just get a response, especially from our students here, from Lowell and Lauren, talking about training for mental health professionals, 24/7 access to mental health professionals or mental health care. To you, Lowell, is that, does that seem like a move in the right direction?
I personally, just from my own experience, I think the 24/7 thing is really huge, because that was the situation I found myself in which it was well after hours for counseling and psychological services. And I had called them. They did have someone on kind of available to an emergency line, but unfortunately there was no really buddy professionally there on call. It was a nurse, and her best advice was to take him to the emergency room, which thankfully worked in that situation. Right. But I really think that for students, especially, you know, themselves, to be able to have a line that they can call up and talk to somebody who's well-versed, well-trained, and compassionate, I think that's a really big step in the right direction. I would say the school provides a lot of amazing services, but that's one that I think is a big, big step forward.
What do you think, Lauren?
Yeah, I'd agree with Lola, and I'd also think that the faculty and staff training part is also really important. I think it's very difficult for students to go up to a professor and say, you know, I'm going through a tough time. Can I get an extension? Can I, you know, I have to take some time off of school. Students don't really know how to do that, and I think faculty don't always know how to respond or in what cases is this legitimate. You know, where is this crossing a line? That's really important.
Sure. Ed, let me go back to you, and then we're going to have to say goodbye. Sure. I know you wanted to add something. Go ahead.
Yes, I just want to say that the Reporting Act, which is meeting with opposition from small focus groups naturally, because they think it'll alter a person's decision as to which college they will choose. Unfortunately, it is so important. So it's tabled for now. We've agreed to table that. We're pushing the other act because we want to start. We want somewhere to start. But this act, when implemented in the colleges, will require them within 15 days at the beginning of each semester, they shall tell the students via electronic mail the location and contact information of the licensed healthcare professionals which are required pursuant, you know, to that subsection of the law that we said. And also, I think it behooves colleges, because of the rise in suicide rates, I know it doesn't appear that there's a rise, but there is. We require them to notify these students even in an orientation session. It's so important. I don't think it's done now, but we need to start. We need to start with an orientation, you know, session in the beginning of each semester, and let these students know that there are many students facing the same kind of pressure, and that when this unnecessary pressure that they feel begins to overwhelm them, that they have resources in which to turn.
Well, Ed, I really appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. I know there's much more to talk about. Ed Modica talking about the Madison-Hollerin Suicide Prevention Act, the Madison-Hollerin Suicide Reporting Act in New Jersey. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
You're very welcome. Kelly, you want to respond to anything that our three guests have said? And then we do want to get back to our callers.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that or reinforce what's been said. What needs to happen is that everybody on every college campus, every student, every professor, every community member, and frankly, everyone in every other community should know that depression and all mental illness is treatable.
And just underscore that. Lowell was telling us earlier about how he had two friends that were thinking about or talking about committing suicide. And I wonder, back to you, Kelly, and we were actually talking during the break, and he was saying, you know, it's hard to know what do you say to somebody? I mean, literally, what do you say to someone when they say, and you're a friend, and they say, you know, I'm not sure I can go on with this. I'm not sure I can do this anymore. What should somebody say? Kelly?
Well, first of all, people should not be afraid to ask the direct questions. There's been a lot of misunderstanding, you know, throughout the world that if you ask somebody about their suicidal feelings, it will actually cause somebody to feel more suicidal. The science tells us the opposite. There's a seminal piece of science in JAMA showing that if you ask high school students questions about their suicidal feelings, it not only doesn't cause them to be suicidal, it actually doesn't cause even any distress. So we know we need to ask, and we need to ask directly, and that will help us. So in those cases, you want to say let's get you some help and figure out how you can do that as acutely as you need to. And on that note, I feel compelled to actually for people listening to give the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, which is 1-800-273-TALK.
Let me see what Alex from University City has to say. Alex, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a recent graduate of Drexel University, graduate student. I had a bunch of undergraduate friends that went to Penn University. But I want to talk about the access to mental health care for students. You mentioned earlier that, our guest mentioned earlier that, you know, we should treat mental illness as we would any other physical disease. However, you know, if I had cancer or asthma, I would not go to my campus health provider to help to solve those problems. So, one, what can students do? And two, how can they get help? Because a lot of students are on their parents' health plan or maybe don't have health insurance. So getting an outside option can be very expensive and definitely deter people from pursuing help.
It's a good question, and Lowell is nodding his head. Lowell, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that is a really good point because, you know, the treatment, as much as we can say that they are similar, they are diseases, we do know the treatment is usually pretty different. You have to find a very specific therapist that's going to work for you or a counselor that's going to work for you. And as he said, there's so many kind of different issues there with insurance. I do know that very fortunately at the University of Pennsylvania, you either have to have insurance or they put you on their plan, essentially, is the way I understand it is working. So if you're going to Penn, you're, as an undergraduate at least, I'm almost positive that you're going to have insurance and you're going to be able to go and get outside help. But I definitely agree to his point that it's really not, as much as we like to say, yes, it's a disease and it's treatable like a disease, it can be different than the physical, like, well, there's clearly something wrong with me. I need to go to a doctor to get that fixed in a very simple way. I do think there is a bit of a gap there, and I would agree with the point that
Alex was making.
Yeah,
there.
Definitely.
Lauren, let me turn to you. Is there something more the university can and should do? Are students meeting with administration to deal with what looks like the 11th suicide in the last 3 years?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's complicated because suicide and mental health issues are obviously very personal, and there's a lot that students bring with them before they even come to Penn. There's a lot that, you know, is probably not within the university's control. But I do think seeing this happen over and over, there needs to be some action taken on the part of the university. You know, I don't think we can really stop at the mental health task force recommendations, especially as we see this crop up again. I think we need to dive deeper and explore outside of just adding more resources, more helplines, because I think there has to be something more to do.
Kelly, we haven't really talked about parents or families, but they play such a critical role in this. Can you speak to that?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of our major focus across the nation and beyond when we work with communities. What we've all learned is that prevention needs to go into the home and into the families. So when we work with the military, for example, we're training parents and peers how to ask the questions, because like we were talking about before, sometimes those are the only people that are going to be able to identify the person suffering in silence. So there are a lot of efforts to do that, and it's critically important that we put these kind of questions in the hands of family members.
We have an anonymous caller that wants to join us on Radio Times. So go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning. Speaking of stigma, yeah, I actually don't want to give my name because I have been depressed since before college, and I'm now in my 40s. But having been in and out of depression through that time, I do want to emphasize the point that while certainly stress and other other quote-unquote triggers might play a role. The condition of being in depression is not something I think that people who are not depressed can understand. Even, you know, once you're done being depressed, if you're lucky, you can't remember what it was like. Yeah. So the thought that someone who has a suicide plan and is acting on it is someone you can reach by lessening stress or by understanding the causes of it, I think is a bit of a red herring, because in fact the experience of being in depression is existential, and it really is, I can assure you, awful.
You get no argument from anybody here. It looks like you wanted to say something to Lowell. Go ahead.
And I do appreciate Lowell. I do think that the idea of speaking to someone is crucial, and Lowell's his being the person who was spoken to and being accessible in that way is critical, because you do, if you have a plan, you do want to talk to somebody about it and find out that your plan doesn't make sense, and find out that somebody does care about you, and find out sort of the things behind that. Lowell interfered very directly in a plan, but I think with his first friend, he certainly was making someone see that there's another perspective, which is critical. Once you feel, when you're in depression, you can't feel correctly, but sometimes you can think your way into getting yourself help.
And the
medical help is crucial.
Absolutely. So it's such an important call. Lowell, you want to respond? And it sounds like you want to add something, Kelly.
I definitely agree. It's not even that much of a challenge, really. It's just kind of just don't allow yourself to. I mean, I had essentially, I'll full disclosure, had gone through some mental health issues myself in my senior year of high school, and had kind of a similar to Tim earlier, an overdiagnosis essentially occur. So I already kind of knew what it could be like to try to seek out help and not have it go quite how you expected. So I think just kind of calming down and just saying, well, I'm just going to talk to this person about it. I'm not going to be the savior. I'm not going to try to act like I'm no better than them. You just talk to them. And I think what you said, to show them that there are different points of view and different ways to look at it, is really huge. I think it is kind of what makes us humans at a
Absolutely.
Certain point.
Kelly, our caller just talked about how the pain of being depression. And I think sometimes we throw the word depression or depressed around without really understanding the deep psychological pain that someone who is depressed, what they feel. Can you speak to that?
Yes. When we talk about clinical depression, biological depression, it's a constellation of lots of different things that encompass that person in this black hole that was driven by their biology. So it's feeling sad or irritable all the time, losing interest or not having pleasure in things, you know, having appetite difficulty, not wanting to eat, having sleep difficulty, feeling suicidal is one of the symptoms, having trouble concentrating. And, you know, so there are eight different symptoms that all come together at the same time to put the person in this terrible place. Again, the good news being that we actually have made a lot of progress in knowing how to treat it. But what I wanted to add to that is when Lowell was just talking about, you know, what you do when we were with that person, or I was mentioning about families and friends, we're not talking about anybody being in the place to do a risk evaluation. We're just talking about not being afraid to ask, so you can know if your friend or loved one is suffering and be able to facilitate, you know, help for them that they so need.
Well, there's so much more to say. That seems like a good place to end our conversation. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Kelly Posner, Gersten Haber, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
And she's founder, principal investigator of the Columbia Lighthouse Project. That's at Columbia University. And she's a member of the board of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Lauren Feiner, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a junior at Penn, also editor-in-chief of the Daily Pennsylvanian. And Lowell Newman, Nikki, thank you very much for joining us and telling us a bit about yourself and your friends.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. He is a sociology major, a senior at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the program. Abby Sarfo, our intern for today's show. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. The show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.